Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt. This is another podcast for the Beyond the Mekong series, which is broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today is Cambodia's most well-known, highly regarded historian, Henri Lacarte. Henri, welcome to the program.
Yes, I believe I'm the oldest Frenchman in this country.
Well, you're 85.
But no, but from the time nobody has come known Cambodia since 1984, when I was a student.
Right, 64.
So, 64, from 1964. Yeah. So that's a vast number of years, about 60.
The 50th anniversary of the fall of Phnom Penh, which was followed swiftly by the fall of Saigon, the communist forces taking over Indochina in 1975. The 50th anniversary is approaching fast. It's in April. Take us back. How did Pol Pot come to power in Cambodia?
Yes, well, immediately I would correct you a little bit.
Please.
Because there was something very specific about Khmer communism. Mm-hmm. It was not a single dictator.
Right.
While all other communist regimes, you had Lenin, you had Stalin, you had Mao, you had Kim Il-sung, who completely towered over the rest of society. Mm-hmm. A unique personality, the dictator with the capital D. Not so in Cambodia. It was a group of people, an organization, they called themselves an Angkor. And what was so specific and so unusual and weird about it was that they were anonymous, secret.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's only in the middle of the regime, October 1977, that, urged by the Chinese, Pol Pot came out. And he said, I am the party secretary and I'm the leader of this country. Which was not quite true, because it was a duum vere, two people. His second, or brother number two, was Nguyen Chia, and is by far as important as Pol Pot. And I have plenty of examples of that, and many testimonies, all the testimonies you read, when you had meetings, major meetings, for instance, just after the fall of Phnom Penh, at the end of April 75, beginning of May, there was a big meeting at the Institute of Technology of the Soviet School, and the big speakers were Nguyen Chi and Pol Pot. Mm-hmm. And Pol Pot, sometimes Nguyen Chi spoke first, and Pol Pot just repeated the ideas of Nguyen Chi. And the ideas of Nguyen Chi we know, thanks to his interview with the Communist Party of Denmark. You might have seen that. Mm. It was in July 77. And he's the one who invented the very weird theory that, one, there were spies everywhere.
Right.
There were spies of the CIA, but at the same time, there were spies of the KGB. Mm. And on top of that, as neither Americans nor Russians could spy in Cambodia, they used Vietnamese spies.
Right.
So they were the three spies at the same time. That's an invention of Nguyen Chia.
You've hit on a contentious point. The reason why I'm saying this is because for a long time I felt Nguyen Chia actually ran the Khmer Rouge. And there was a meeting, I think, with the Chinese in the early 1960 or 61, around then. And Nguyen Chia, he loathed the Chinese. He had a personal distaste, shall we say, for the Chinese. And the Chinese found him totally unacceptable. And it was at some point after that, the Pol Pot.
I'm not so sure of that.
Yeah.
The people I knew he loathed were the Vietnamese.
Right.
Why? Because a communist regime, and particularly the Khmer Rouge regime, is absolute power, is totalitarian power. And he soon understand, because he was trained, as you know, as everybody knows, in Thailand, right? And he was almost a full law degree, so he's quite well educated. But then when he came over to Cambodia around 1950, he went over to Hanoi, and he was trained for 2.5 years by not so much by Ho Chi Minh, who was now at that time quite old, but his successors. Mm-hmm. And this is when he realized that the Vietnamese were so keen to see Cambodia and Laos become communists, because the obsession of the Vietnamese Communist Party was to recreate French Indochina.
Sure, it was Indochina's
which was governed from Hanoi.
Right.
And once Nguyen understood that, because he wanted absolute power too, mm-hmm. he loathed the Chinese, the Vietnamese, but he never showed it, because in his 2.5 years in Hanoi, he learned Vietnamese, and he was a good Vietnamese speaker, not just Thai, Khmer, and Vietnamese. He didn't know much French because he'd never been to France, and therefore, during all these years, from 1973, when the Vietnamese started left Cambodia, Vietnamese communists, to 1979, or 1978, when they broke, he was the chief negotiator between the Khmer, Anka, between the Khmer leadership and the Vietnamese leadership. And he was the kindest of men, flattering them, paying compliments, and the Vietnamese were convinced that there were two tendencies among the Khmer Rouge, the pro-Chinese and the pro-Vietnamese. And the head of the pro-Vietnamese was Nguyen Chi. While Nguyen Chi is always hiding, was so clever, because he said, we must remain secrets. Secrecy is how we survive. So he was hiding everything in his inner feelings, and he was hiding this hatred of the Vietnamese. This is why, in 1979, when the Vietnamese took to trial in August 1979,
right.
Pol Pot and Yang Sari, mm-hmm. they said there was a, what's the word? I forgot. Pol Pot, the leaders were Pol Pot,
Yang Sari. And this is, of course, is the first tribunal of the Khmer Rouge.
That's right.
After they were ousted by the Vietnamese.
And they could not have been more mistaken, except when they were in Ratanakiri, 1970, where really Pol Pot and Yang Sari were working hand in hand. But after that, Yang Sari was mainly traveling abroad, only interested in foreign affairs. Yep. And he was not concerned at all by the way the country was run. The country was run by Pol Pot and Nguyen Chi. So the big question, have the Vietnamese been so ignorant that they did not know that Yang Sari was not number two? He was number four or number five. He was after Khi Somphon and Son Sen. So these are the five people.
Sure.
He's only number five in the leadership. I believe that they took him, one, because he was very much China man. And at that time, the Vietnamese Communist Party was very anti-Chinese. And he was also the man through which the dollars were supplied. Because everybody knows that the Chinese gave a lot of weapons and all kinds of machinery, implements, and so on to Cambodia. But they also gave dollars. How did Yang Sari travel to the New York?
Right.
with, of course, Chinese money. And he had two bank accounts. I think he had two bank accounts in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
So it's true that financially and as far as the foreign relations are concerned, Yang Sari was very important and was China man. But they must have known that Nguyen Chi was a very important character. And I'm convinced, but that's a hypothesis I cannot really prove. To lead the People's Republic of Kampuchea, PRK, the next regime, under the trinity of
Heng Samrin,
Heng Sari, Chia Sim, and Hun Sen, none of them were major leaders. They were very secondary leaders. Hun Sen, particularly, was very young.
Yeah.
He was just the middle officer. And I'm just checking from the tribunal, the interview of the tribunal, Heng Sari. Chiu Sim had some education because he went to the good pagodas, and in particular to the pagoda near the Royal Palace.
Right.
So
it's where Pol Pot was a spent much of his youth in the
as
in
a
the
child.
Royal Court. Yes.
No, as a very small child.
Sure, but it's something for his resume.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a kid who was
Heng Samrin.
Yeah.
In his autobiography, mm-hmm. says nothing about his education. So I thought, because he came from a very poor family, while...
I think Heng Samrin was very different to the others. I have read his autobiography.
Came from a rich family.
Right.
Heng Samrin came from a very poor family with only 1 hectare. And in this generation, he's still alive.
He still lives out on that land.
Yes. He's 84, he's 85 or something. And he might have... not even been to school. I was mistaken. He went 5 years to primary school. So he had 5 years of primary school, so he can just read and write, but no more. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is not the big catch for the Vietnamese. And I was convinced that they did not take Nguyen Chi to court because they were still convinced in August 1979 that they could win over to them Nguyen Chi. Because they thought he was the head of the pro-Vietnamese faction.
When really he was...
And not only he was not the head of the pro-Vietnamese mm-hmm. faction, but he hated Vietnamese. And there was no pro-Vietnamese faction.
Right.
There was none. And
I remember the banana leaf line, mm-hmm. which was Prem Nakhon Saigon. Uh-huh. And the argument was that Pol Pot, that was at the time, my guess is it would have been Nguyen Chi, they wanted to invade and take back everything south. Mm. The banana leaf line, Prem Nakhon or Saigon.
Mm.
And it was obviously completely unrealistic. That could not be done. Mm. Nevertheless, this was in their thinking.
All right, so perhaps that's my interpretation, mm-hmm. but I cannot find evidence of that.
Why were they so brutal?
What?
Why were they so brutal?
That's another question. Well, I started answering that because they had so few people supporting them.
Mm.
They could not rule by consensus because everybody hated the regime because nobody had expelled from their own homes everybody, but practically everybody, well, all the town dwellers.
Right, you're talking about the evacuation.
But even the farmers, the peasants, mm-hmm. they kept being moved around too. So everybody was being moved. So, of course, everybody loathes that. And, of course, the abolition of money, of course, was extremely unpopular. And one of my witnesses, I said, oh, I'm sure in 10 years' time, the money would be reinstated because it's just impossible to have a society without money.
Sure.
Anyway, there were such... And then, of course, is the famine,
mm-hmm.
which I think no other communist regime. There were many people who died of famine under the Great Leap Forward in China because there was no rice. And the rice was sent to the Soviet Union, to Russia. Because there was a shortage of rice. But in Cambodia, people starved not because there was a shortage of rice, there's plenty of rice. But because it's taken from all the Sahakor, the people's communes.
Right.
Right, but the main thing I wanted to talk about is how is it that they came to power,
yes.
since they had so little support in the country. There are four main causes.
Mm-hmm.
Two are internal, and two are external. The internal causes is because this Anka, these five people, wanted absolute power.
Mm-hmm.
All the five of them, right. One. Two, because in 1970, Sihanouk went, instead of going to France in his villa in Provence, he went to China.
Right, this was after Sihanouk was... ousted. Some would say a CIA-inspired coup. I don't agree with that. I actually think it was just a vote in Parliament. But he was ousted and he went to China.
He was ousted absolutely legally because I looked at the Constitution
mm-hmm.
and the amendment to the Constitution that were made in 1960-something when he decided, because he wanted to change the Constitution because the Constitution gave him no power and
right.
he wanted power. So he asked many lawyers, Cambodian lawyers, French lawyers, and they kept saying, no, we can do nothing, we can do nothing. Then one night, he had this brilliant idea. Oh, I just abdicate. Now, many royal kings are abdicated because they don't like power. They want to go back to the civil. No, because he wanted to seize absolute power. So his abdication enabled him to restore absolute monarchy, because he was still the monarch and the king for everybody.
Right, okay.
So, Sihanouk in 1970, people basically why he was dismissed. Because he had allowed the Vietnamese communists to use the sanctuaries in the whole of eastern Cambodia.
Yes, the Ho Chi Minh trail.
The Ho Chi Minh trail. It first started that the Vietnamese came uninvited.
Mm-hmm.
As early as 62, 63, 64, they started trickling down. Then they were so numerous and there were so many parallel tracks that people realized that they were there. So Sihanouk decided more or less to close his eyes and pretend that they were not there. And the third, lately he went to Hanoi and signed his consent that they use the Ho Chi Minh trail.
Right, and people were getting big cuts off the weapons and, sales as well.
And what?
There were quite a few people, and I understand Sihanouk as well. They were getting a cut off the weapons sales.
Absolutely.
And that's Pathet Lao, North Vietnamese Army, Viet Cong, the Khmer Rouge. Yeah. I mean, there's at least four groups in there, plus the Chinese.
This is basically when they became so numerous and visible that the general population got very angry. And Sihanouk said, well, we are going to organize, because all the demonstrations under Sihanouk were organized by Sihanouk.
Right.
You could not run demonstrations without the consent of the government or of Sihanouk. So he asked the young people, youth, to demonstrate against the officers of the Viet Minh and the officers of the Viet Cong in Phnom Penh, but just make demonstrations around it. They did not just make demonstrations, but they took siege on the place and destroyed everything.
Got out of control.
They got completely out of control.
That has happened here before. Not just
and it happened before, right? Yeah. When they destroyed the British Council. Because my friend, Hakim, they did the same with the British Council.
I was thinking of the Thai riots in 2003.
And the Thai riots, that's right. And Sihanouk said, I am going to use diplomacy, because he thought he was a great diplomat.
Mm-hmm.
And I am going to ask the two supporters of the Viet Minh, because Viet Minh and Viet Cong are more or less the same, who are in the Soviet Union and in China, I'm just going to talk to them nicely and convince them that their protégé have to leave my country because my compatriots no longer bear the presence of so many foreign troops in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
So he first went to... and then the situation was getting a little bit out of control in Phnom Penh. There were so many demonstrations that they urged Sihanouk to come back and sort the situation. And he refused. He absolutely refused to come back to Phnom Penh. And instead was in the Soviet Union in Moscow. And it is while he was in Moscow that he heard that he had been dismissed.
Right.
And that is the big, big political mistake of Sihanouk. Instead of going back to Paris, from which he came, he went east.
And that's when he went on radio and he urged Cambodians to join the Khmer Rouge.
3 days later, he was dismissed on the 20th of March, 1973. On the 23rd, it didn't take many days, he made a big declaration on the radio, please and join Monsignor Papa, into the Maquis. And that was repeated again and again and again and again on the Radio Democratic Cambodia, which broadcast from Hanoi. And in my field work and my research of the provincial prisons, I have plenty of examples of people who said, I joined the revolution because I answered Sihanouk's call.
Now, I have a question for you, because I've spoken to other academics and they are brilliant academics with a lot of experience in the field. And my question for you is what I put to them. There was one estimate that the Khmer Rouge numbered about 5,000 before Sihanouk urged people to join the Khmer Rouge in the marquee.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, okay, Craig Etchison and Steve Hedder, the numbers vary, but I have heard that because of what Sihanouk said and did, the numbers of the Khmer Rouge went from 5, some say to 30 or 50,000. How many people do you think?
Well, we absolutely cannot know, but this is the range of figures, and I entirely agree. Stephen Hedder is a very serious researcher.
Mm-hmm.
He speaks perfect Khmer. He knows much more Khmer than any other researchers. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely true that before Sihanouk joined them, there were a tiny, tiny number of soldiers. And people from the periphery, people who'd never gone to school, and the Chuntiet, the ethnic minorities from Mondulkiri, not so much from Manmeni, Ratanakiri, and the Kukulung in Pravihir also, from the northeast.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps at the beginning, 10 or 20%, you know, in this core were from ethnic minorities. People who'd never been to school.
And there were not a lot of schools in Cambodia at that time either.
And there was still a lot of illiteracy in Cambodia.
Yep.
Because this is one of the bad things that the French did not do, is that they did not develop the educational system. They just renovated the pagoda schools. But there was only one secondary school when the French left.
In the entire country.
In the entire country.
Yeah, people forget that.
That's a big, big mistake. But the French didn't have, there were very few on the ground.
But they
didn't have the money to do it.
Sure, but this goes back to the celebration of the Sankum period in the 1960s, where there's this portrayal that life in Cambodia was going through this marvellous kind of evolution. Mm. They had one school.
That's right.
You can't.
Yes, and this is the main achievement of Sihanouk. Sihanouk did very bad things, but very, very good thing. He's an artist, so he beautified Phnom Penh. He made the beautiful buildings in Phnom Penh.
In the film industry.
He was an artist, he was a singer. And he thought education, because his education had been stopped at grade 11, he would have liked to, because he was quite clever and articulate and probably academic, and he would have easily got a master, PhD, and so on. But he was stopped because he was put on the throne when he never asked for it.
Right.
So he's been so frustrated not having full education as he would have liked, that he made a tremendous effort and he built these beautiful upper secondary schools, which were not on the French model, because the French model is contrary to the English model. I don't know so much about Australia, but the French school is just building.
Right.
In England, it's building plus plenty of land all around for sports, for agriculture, for woodwork, or all kinds of things, everything. And he did that in this country. He built beautiful buildings, which are, almost all of them have survived to this day. And they are still used. Look at Sisawat, it's still the old building.
Sisawat, just for the record, is probably the best government-run school in the country.
Absolutely, yes. And he insisted on sports too, very much. So that's the very positive side of Sihanouk.
So what went wrong?
What went wrong was that he wanted absolute power, and he refused to negotiate with the elite, because what was wrong? He wanted to be left. He wanted to have sympathies for socialism or communism. Neutralism was a good idea. Except that he abandoned neutralism because he broke diplomatic relations with America, and he realized afterwards it was a big mistake and rejected American aid. So he renegotiated in 68-69, and the Americans had reopened their embassies in 69. So that was his big mistake. So between 65, 63, he redismissed the Americans, 63 and 69, de facto he abandoned neutralism and he became pro-Chinese. And he was even boast, I'm going to be the only member of a royal family to be communist. Because he was convinced by the French, and this was the time when communism was very popular in France, 25%, you know, the Communist Party in France was 25% of the votes, plus half of the elite, all my colleagues, or the older half of my colleagues were Marxist. Marxist. So he thought that Marxism, Leninism, was the future of society. And as he wanted to remain in power, I want to move with progress.
Right.
So that's the fault of the French, of course. Yes.
Now, I think we have what's called horseshoe politics, but it's pretty much the same.
Well, the English-speaking world, who were much more practical, really saw that economically, communism was a disaster. But the French, who always in dreams, you know, so-called intellectuals or people completely cut up from reality.
There was a romanticism about it all that seemed to be attached to communism in the books and the literature, movies, film noir.
But it's what is remarkable is about his nearest friend was Nieck Toulon, with whom I've been working too. Nieck Toulon, number two, you know, was in all his films and so on. They were fiercely anti-communist. All of them, Son San, all the leaders. Nieck Toulon has written a marvelous history book, which I edited, and I hope it will come out. And even make an English translation, and I hope it will be translated into English. It's called Khmer Chronicle. And I have annotated it, and I have more than 30 pages of notes of all the politicians in Cambodia in the 50s and the 60s.
Right.
And the book covers one century of Cambodian history, 1863 to 1969, when, and this is very symbolical, Nieck Toulon said to Sihanouk, well, you go east, I go to Paris, and abandoned him with his family, except one daughter who remained, and she was killed at Tourzelay. And among the entire elite, except, what's his name, one who was the prime minister afterwards.
Pen Savan was the first prime minister with the Vietnamese.
No, with Sihanouk, who was, there was one of that generation who followed Sihanouk in Beijing. What was his name? And he became under the Khmer Rouge before the prime minister was Pol Pot. It was for a few months, I forgot his name. Anyway, there was just among this set of the Democratic Party, because Sihanouk killed the Democratic Party. He killed the Democrats. They were center-left. They were close to the Socialist Party in France. He killed them. And he manipulated the elections and put people in prison and so on.
This was...
Sihanouk, he destroyed the Democratic Party.
Sure, this was what year?
This is from 1955 to...
Late
50s, beginning of the 60s. And they all went to Paris.
What was the fundamental difference between the communists in Vietnam and the communists, I know what you might say, but the communists in Cambodia and the communists in Vietnam, or South Vietnam, was quote-unquote liberated. That did not happen here.
Yes, before I answer your question, I want to finish answering the why they came to power. Because of this group, five Khmer Rouge and Sihanouk. Now, there are external reasons. These are the internal reasons. The external reasons is that it is the Soviet Union and who asked Ho Chi Minh to create not just a Communist Party of Vietnam, but in the Indo-Chinese Communist Party in 1930. And in the branch, the Khmer branch, we are composed only of Vietnamese and Chinese originally, right?
And they were speaking for the Cambodians and the Lao, which
was it was
acceptable.
A completely Vietnamese initiative. One, the Vietnam brought Marxism-Leninism to Cambodia, and two, it's around between 66 and 1970 when the Chinese took over. And you could look at the armament, the weapons, for instance. When the Vietnamese were in charge during the Civil War now started in 68, not in 17, 68.
I thought 67 in Sam Lott.
Sam Lott, 67, but they broke exactly when it started. It's 1968.
Okay.
And the Vietnamese were just giving a trickle of weapons. They had virtually no weapons. They also sometimes had stolen weapons that they took from the legal army, from the Republican army. But because the Vietnamese told them, we first take Saigon, and once we take Saigon, we shall help you to take Phnom Penh. That was the theory. So they refrained from allowing Chinese and Soviet weapons to go to the Khmer Rouge.
Right.
But it suddenly changed from 1970, when Sihanouk was in charge from in Beijing, or partly in charge. And I just have evidence that full trucks or lorries full of Kalashnikov arrived in Ratanakere in the northeast from 1972-73, when the Vietnamese were leaving. So it's the Chinese took over afterwards. And if you did not have all the Kalashnikov for the Khmer Rouge, there would have been no evacuation of the cities. People left their homes because it was people who did not come gently, now please leave home for a few days.
They had guns pointed down.
Guns pointed at them. If there'd been no guns, there would have been no evacuation. So the Chinese are completely responsible for the evacuation of all the cities, not just Phnom Penh, all the provincial cities, not just the provincial capitals, but the big villages, or small cities,
sure,
throughout
the
mainland.
Towns, the cities, the whole, everybody was moved.
So to come back to your question,
yep,
about what's the difference with the Vietnamese and the Cambodians, well, first and foremost is that, like, I make a parallel with Roman Catholicism, I don't know if I'm right or not, because communism operated very much like a religion, with its gods, its saints, its martyrs, and its sacrifices, and so on. And the French missionaries came to Indochina from the 16th, 17th century, and they had some success in Vietnam, and no success at all in Cambodia, nothing. So the Vietnamese did not need to be that cruel, because they have a significant percentage of the population, who they could have been 10, 15, 20%. They never were a majority. The communist regime in Vietnam never came to power democratically, because they never had, since 1945 in the north and 1975 in the south, democratic elections. But still, there were a significant majority, so they did not have to use ultimate violence. While the Khmers, there was no communist in Cambodia, virtually. It had no appeal, just as there's no Catholics. Or virtually no Catholics.
It was a complete alien philosophy. By the time they got here, there was no one got it. I remember the Vietnamese, many years ago, I interviewed Pen Savan, who was first Prime Minister.
I interviewed him too.
Vietnamese.
He's quite a nice man.
He was a lovely bloke, and he told me much.
Yeah.
But he was, I think what came across in that interview was how alien the Vietnamese sense of communism was when they tried to impose it after the invasion in late 78, early 79.
Yeah, yeah.
And that they tried to install local people's committees, which are very popular in Saigon.
Yeah, yeah.
They're basically self-ruling blocks the suburbs and cities.
Yeah.
And they tried to, not impose, but they tried to create that sense of government in Cambodia. And it just didn't work.
Yeah, yeah, it didn't work.
Yes. Just complete alien concepts.
And it's a big paradox of Cambodians. As a nation, they are very, very strong culture. They're very artistic people. They are excellent painters, musicians, draftsmen, sculptors. Mm. You have all of them. But they have no sense of what is a state and no sense of public good. It's they live at the level of the clan or the family, but not the nation. They don't know. You see how they drive on the road. They drive as if they were alone, as the road was their property.
And on that note, Henri Lacarde, been a fascinating chat. I'd like to do this again. At 85 years old, you're still going strong. What's next for you over the next year or two?
Well, I want to try and find a publisher for my book on the Khmer prison system. It's quite a big book. I have about 500 pages. Mm-hmm. I have a summary of the prison system in the countryside, and one specifically on Karantachan, because we have archives from Karantachan. And I analyzed the archives of Karantachan for the conference of David Chandler in Australia. And I went all the way to Melbourne when he retired. It was in December 2010 or something. And I produced my research, and it was not published. So I thought, oh, my paper was rejected because there were so many people. There was no specific subject. It was about Cambodia in general. Sure. So I thought, well, my... And then, in fact, the minutes of the conference were never published. Not sure, just my paper.
Right, but it's...
So it's in my book, and they do mention Karantachan at the tribunal. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that is very surprising, and that's what I'm in the process of trying to find out, is how is it that the tribunal was only interested in S21, basically.
Mm-hmm. When there were 200 of them around
that's
the
right.
country, sentinels.
And yes, they are Karantachan, that was mentioned too, but that's about all. There was virtually no field work. Mm. So, because I stopped when the tribunal started, but then in the end, I don't say I covered all the prisons.
I don't think anybody could have.
I might have covered three quarters, you know. Mm-hmm. I have to count how many prisons have been through. Because there was not just one person.
No, there was 200 at least. That
yes,
was my
there
my
was
count.
Not just one per district.
Sure.
But in many districts, there were several prisons.
Indeed.
And
it sounds like the subject for another podcast, which perhaps we can do later this year. Yes. Okay. With me is a copy of Henri Lacarde's book, Jungle Heart of the Khmer Rouge, which was published by NIAZ, the Scandinavian publishers. They do a lot of academic books, but it's a great read. I'm going to recommend it right now as we sign off. Henri Lacarde, thank you very much.
You can have hardback or paperback.